Thank you so much for that very kind introduction. And thanks so much to Carrie, Anne, and Joe for inviting me to speak in front of all of you. And thanks so much to all of you for coming and braving the rain. So I thought I would begin this evening in true Twain fashion with a bracing bit of candor. So brace yourselves. When Carrie, Anne, and Joe first asked me to give this talk back in October of 2016, it was quite a while ago, I was flattered, honored, and completely terrified. The prospect of making a pilgrimage to this holy site in Twain's life, a place I had seen photographs of and had read about and even written about, but had never actually visited, was genuinely thrilling, as was the opportunity to join all of you in a celebration of a man I had spent so much time thinking about. But the reality, which quickly set in after the initial burst of enthusiasm faded, was that it had been years since I'd thought about Twain at all. The book that I wrote about him, which focuses on his early years as a young writer in San Francisco in the 1860s, came out 3 years ago, which meant that I finished it 4 years ago and wrote it 5 to 6 years ago. And in the years since the book came out, I've done all sorts of very non-Twain things. I started working in the tech industry and stopped writing about American history, mostly in favor of writing about technology and politics. Over the last few years, I've mostly been thinking about things like the internet, cloud computing, artificial intelligence, digital currency, and how all of these new technologies intersect and interact with society, culture, and politics. So how the hell was I going to talk about Twain? How would I stand up in front of a room full of you, full of Twain experts and enthusiasts, and follow in the forbiddingly large footsteps of figures like Ron Powers and Ken Burns, and speak coherently for 30-odd minutes about a man who had hardly crossed my mind in years? These were only a few of the 9 unanswerable questions that descended on me in October of 2016. In the following weeks and months, they proliferated, they intensified, they haunted more and more of my waking hours. In March, Joe wrote me an email asking for a title and a brief description of my talk. This very reasonable request triggered another death spiral of nerves. If my anxiety had formerly been chronic, it now entered what we might call the acute phase. I responded to Joe promptly, providing a few sentences on what an interesting talk about Twain might look like. But inwardly, I felt like an imposter, a fraud. It's easy enough to project confidence over email, but I felt absolutely certain that soon the jig would be up, my bluff would be called, and the final humiliation, when it came, would be devastating. In computer programming, there's something called an infinite loop. It happens when you've written a program that keeps executing its instructions over and over because the terminating condition is never met. It's the digital equivalent of Einstein's famous and possibly apocryphal definition of insanity, doing the same thing again and again and expecting a different result. The solution to an infinite loop is to manually kill the process, to tell the operating system to abort the program, and then rewrite it. So that's what I needed to do, to kill the loop in my brain that was consuming precious processing power without making any actual progress, and refactor the program to run properly with a successful exit. Now, I'm sure the suspense is killing you, and I'm even more sure that you'd actually like to have me start talking about Twain. So let's fast forward to the moment when I realized what I had to do to actually sit down and write this talk. I had to conjure Mark Twain back into my life. I mean this quite literally. During the time that I'd written my book, Twain took up residence in my brain. As many of you no doubt know, writing a book destroys your life. Right? It consumes all the time allotted for it and everything else besides. All those hours you had hoped to do normal human things like socializing, cooking, watching television, must be sacrificed to the hungry monster that lives inside every manuscript. In my case, that hungry monster took the physical form of Twain himself. It wasn't merely that I thought about him a lot. I would actually see and hear the man on a daily basis. My wife would often say that we had to kick Mark Twain out of our room at night. He would be sitting there at the foot of our bed, puffing a cigar, guzzling scotch, spinning a yarn in that inimitable drawl, what Twain's mother memorably called his slow talk, what a reporter once described as a little buzzsaw slowly grinding inside a corpse. I would hear this voice all the time. I'd hear it when I went to sleep, and I'd hear it when I woke up. In fact, it was hard not to hear it. Eventually, though, Twain departed. I finished the book, and he moved on. It was bittersweet, of course, but it was the best thing for everyone. He could go torment some other writer, and my wife wouldn't have to kick a strange man out of our bed every night. But if I was going to give this talk, I had to restore Twain to the former spot he occupied inside my skull, if only for a brief period. So I prepared a seance of sorts. I knew that Twain, while a great satirist and skeptic of Christianity, was fascinated by the supernatural, and had even tried to contact his dead daughter, Susie, through spiritual means. As a result, I thought he might prove responsive to a paranormal request to his presence. This is true. This is all true. Now, the setting for my seance would be my childhood bedroom in my parents' house in San Francisco. This was the place where I'd initially conceived of the book idea during a trip visiting them. It also happens to be the place where I've stored all the materials I use in writing the book. It's quite a small room. There's a door and three walls. One is a small bed, one is a desk, and one are bookshelves. And under the bed are boxes and boxes of photocopies and notes from archival research I conducted, and the shelves are filled with books that I had used while writing my own book. So I dumped all these items on my desk, and I covered it with everything I'd used to write my book. I didn't burn any incense or do any chanting. I just sat down and I tried to concentrate as hard as I could on summoning Twain back into my brain. The first question, of course, was which Twain to summon, because there were many Twains, as you all know. Perhaps the most famous Twain is Twain, the American legend, right? The man in the white suit, dispensing sparkling bits of eminently quotable wit. Impish, but basically inoffensive, ironic, but never cruel. This is the Twain that looms largest in popular memory, the Twain I was taught in school, and one that I've always found boring. This is the avuncular Twain, his sharp edges sanded down, bloodless and defanged, another esteemed mummy of American literature. This was not the Twain I was interested in. This was never the Twain I was interested in. The Twain I wanted to talk to again was the Twain I'd written a book about, the young Twain, intemperate, insecure, caustic, crass. I wanted to talk to the Twain who, in his own words, got drunk oftener than was necessary, was wild, godless, idle, lecherous, and a discontented and unsettled rover. Most of all, I wanted to talk to the Twain who was awakening to his vocation as a moralist, who, in the course of scraping out a living as a bohemian journalist in 1860s San Francisco, was discovering a way to weaponize humor against injustice. While this was the same Twain I'd gotten to know years ago, this time our encounter would be a bit different. Back when I was writing my book, I'd asked Twain one question over and over, in as many different ways I could think of. How did you become a writer? How did you transform yourself from Hannibal's Sam Clemens, typesetter, small town scribbler, steamboat captain, into America's Mark Twain? This time I had a different question. Again, I found a variety of ways to ask it, but it boiled down to, why is American life in the second decade of the 21st century so degraded and demoralizing? Why is America so scary? And how can it ever get better? Before I continue, let me preface what follows by sounding a few cautionary notes about the dangers of claiming Twain for one's political ends. Everyone wants a piece of Twain. This was true towards the end of his life as he became America's most famous writer. It's especially true now, given his preeminent status in the American literary canon. I've seen this phenomenon most frequently with geography. Many states around the country and many countries around the world claim to have played some formative role in Twain's evolution as a writer. New York and Connecticut, California and Missouri all have a legitimate case, of course, but I can't tell you the number of times someone approached me at a book reading to tell me that Twain had visited their hometown in such and such a year, and it made such a major impression on him that he couldn't have written Huck Finn without it. It must happen to all of you as well. So the point of this is that we should try to show some restraint when claiming Twain. We should certainly resist the temptation to enlist him into one side or another in contemporary political debates. But that doesn't mean we can't summarize the man's politics. Twain was absolutely outspoken on a number of political issues. He was, on the whole, an anti-racist and anti-imperialist. He was a strong supporter of the labor movement and a great admirer of Edward Bellamy's vision of a socialist society as presented in the bestseller Looking Backward. But these sympathies existed alongside and often in tension with his class position and his personality. After all, Twain was also a lifelong entrepreneur and speculator who earned large sums of money as a best-selling author and popular speaker, who married into a wealthy industrialist family, and who benefited from the great acceleration of American capitalism triggered by the Civil War, which he himself, of course, christened the Gilded Age. Twain was what we might call a champagne socialist, and I mean this in a purely descriptive sense, not in a critical one. His love for making and spending money was sincere. So was his desire for a more equitable and just society. And it's worth pointing out that this desire could take a particularly radical form. A famous passage from a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court about the French Revolution reads as an unambiguous defense of revolutionary violence. And in 1906, 4 years before his death, Twain would tell a journalist that, quote, "I am always on the side of the revolutionists because there never was a revolution unless there were some oppressive and intolerable conditions against which to revolute." Sometimes people ask me what the most surprising thing I find about American history, as I've written books about it, as I've written about it, and learned about it. And I always say the same thing. The most surprising thing I find about American history is that for hundreds of years, some millions of white Americans thought slavery was normal. That is, they had no problems with the following: stealing human beings from their home, forcing them to work for free, and buying and selling them as property. It's not just the scale of the atrocity I find so staggering. It's knowing that there were so many living and breathing individuals for whom slavery was an acceptable, even desirable state of affairs. It's knowing that this unimaginable quantity of cruelty was sanctioned and sometimes even celebrated by official morality. This fact never fails to astonish me, and I think it helps unlock the kernel of Twain's politics. I think it helps illuminate how he wielded humor as a weapon against social injustice, and I think it even gives us clues about how we might apply his methods to our own political moment. What Twain found especially intolerable throughout his life was the gap between society's stated ideals and its actual everyday practice, the rift between the rhetoric of democracy and Christianity and humanitarianism and the reality of slavery and exploitation and imperialism. Now, not coincidentally, this rift between rhetoric and reality was also the same that supplied the animating force of frontier humor, which is one of the literary traditions that really forms the early Twain. Frontier humor broadly refers to a set of oral traditions that emerged from the American West in the 18th and 19th centuries. And of course, the precise boundaries of that West were constantly changing, but the term always referred to the place where white settlers ran up against the continent. This collision destroyed native populations. It also created new myths and metaphors and slang and seeded new homegrown strains of oral literature. In 1750, the inhabitants of colonial America numbered little more than a million, and the West was the land beyond the Allegheny Mountains. By 1850, the United States was home to 23 million people, and the West stretched all the way to the Pacific Ocean. Frontier humor emerges from this ever-expanding West as pioneers gathered in taverns and trading posts, stagecoaches and steamboats, to tell funny, fantastic yarns that reflected the new realities of Western life, surreal comic fictions called tall tales that belong to a constantly evolving cluster of oral traditions. These tales often featured a grisly frontiersman engaging in fantastical feats of violence and speaking strange, gorgeous slang. A Tennessee trapper or a Mississippi boatman might thump his chest and claim that he was a snapping turtle or that he was endowed with bear's claws and the devil's tail. Or he might spin a yarn about that time that Daniel Boone wrestled bears in Kentucky and Davy Crockett battled a 12-foot catfish in Tennessee. Or how in Utah, this is my favorite one, grasshoppers grew so big they were barbecued like steaks. Imagine a steak. Is that true? Got to get out there. On the frontier, laughter was the great unifier, right? In a society of strangers, it created a sense of community. Now, I have to say, the white pioneers of the American West don't particularly deserve our sympathy. They were foot soldiers in a brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing that decimated Native populations. But it's also indisputably true that they lived hard lives in strange and often terrifying surroundings. Humor helped ease their gloom and isolation. It let them chronicle what the frontier felt like. It let them laugh at themselves and bond over what they had in common. And one thing they especially had in common was the cruelty of frontier life, because of course there was no shortage of ways for white people to die in the West. They could die slowly from starvation or exposure, or suddenly from an encounter with a bear or a bobcat or a Native American resisting dispossession. The West could be a very inhospitable place for a pioneer. But that's also what made the West so funny, at least to the darkly comic mind of the frontier humorist. Your average pioneer went West with Jeffersonian stars in his eyes, dreaming of a new world of limitless growth and possibility where he could grab a piece of land, cultivate it, and become an independent, virtuous, self-reliant citizen of the American Republic. The reality was typically far less forgiving. Many of those hoping to make it in the West ran up against a wilderness that terrified, bewildered, resisted, and sometimes even killed them. Confronted with the harsh realities of frontier life, the Jeffersonian dream often came crashing down to earth. This disillusionment, repeated over and over down through the decades, paid major dividends for frontier humorists. They mined it for laughs. They used it to develop darkly funny stories about what happens when a greenhorn sets out from home hoping to find paradise in the wide open spaces of the West and freezes to death in a snowstorm. A particular kind of humor, it's not for everybody. All right, so another feature of frontier humor is its meandering, digressive quality. You can tell it's rubbed off on me as I prepared this talk. But I promise I'll tie it all together, at least I'll try. Twain was a creature of frontier humor. As a boy in Missouri, he immersed himself in a particular strain of it that emerged in the old Southwest. And when Twain went to Nevada in 1861, he found plenty of Southwestern influences on the Pacific coast. The gold rush had drawn hordes of immigrants from the Mississippi River Valley across the plains to the far West. Pikes, they were called, after the Pike County region of Missouri and Illinois. And these Pikes brought their tall talk with them and grafted the humor of past frontiers onto a new one. Twain loved the lacerating wit and yeasty vernacular of frontier humor, its fondness for the gargantuan and the grotesque. Tall talk in particular showed him how to make language more expressive, by embracing a vernacular that reflected the regional varieties of American speech and gave words a more imaginative relationship to the things they described. And of course, that influence is on the most powerful display in works like Jim Smiley and His Jumping Frog and Huckleberry Finn. Now, I apologize for the long digression. I assume that much of that material, maybe all of that material, is familiar to people in the room. But I wanted to lay it out very briefly because I'd like to suggest that frontier humor didn't just give Twain an aesthetic framework, but an ethical one. The power of frontier humor lay in its vulgarity. And I mean the word in two senses. Vulgar in the sense of being obscene and profane, which frontier humor often was, but also vulgar in the sense encased in its Latin root, vulgaris, meaning of the common people, of the masses, of the multitudes. So frontier humor was vulgar not merely because it was so often impolite or offensive, but because it presented a view of the world from below. Twain was often accused of being vulgar, especially when he was an emerging Western writer, formed by the frontier and the traditions of frontier humor, trying to achieve a degree of respectability in an American literary establishment still dominated by a genteel, high culture set centered on New England. But Twain's vulgarity was never simply about being rude or racy or breaking the rules of respectability, though he could certainly do all those things. It was about presenting a view of the world from below, of showing life as it was really lived. It was about describing how Americans really spoke, how they really spent their time. It was about chronicling America as it existed in living, breathing fact, not the image of America manufactured in elite discourse, not the ideal of America celebrated by the pious and the patriotic. It's worth noting parenthetically that William Dean Howells, the great champion and theorist of American literary realism, saw Twain above all as a realist. In his review of Roughing It for the Atlantic, Howells praised Twain for using, quote, the truest colors available to create his portrait of life in the far West. Vulgarity in Twain's hands became a form of radical honesty. It became a method for truth-telling, for the faithful recording and rendering of American life. And this truth-telling encompassed both an aesthetic and an ethical dimension. Picturing America in its truest colors, to borrow Howell's term, involved not just figuring out how to capture the Pike County dialect with sufficient phonetic precision, but probing and exposing that rift between the rhetoric of justice and the reality of injustice. Involved a lot of calling bullshit on the hypocrisy that suffused American life. Now, speaking of calling bullshit, I've been discussing Twain at a somewhat elevated level, so let's bring it down to earth a little bit and discuss a few concrete examples. What I especially loved about writing my book about the young Twain was the opportunity to see him discover his talents, to watch him assemble the literary palette that he would, a bit later in life, put to such great effect. One of the many important discoveries Twain makes in San Francisco as a young writer is that he begins to sharpen his social satire. And he begins to provide his humor with a lacerating moral edge. In 1865 and 1866, Twain is living in San Francisco and he becomes an outspoken critic of police brutality. In fact, there was a wonderful talk earlier today by Benjamin Griffin, who is somewhere here. Which was fantastic, and talked a lot about this. So at that time, Twain is writing a regular column for his old editor at the Virginia City Territorial Enterprise, which is the paper that he worked for before coming to San Francisco. And it's because of this column that Twain becomes public enemy number one of the San Francisco Police Department. Now, at this point, Twain is no stranger to the city's criminal justice system. He had formerly, well, not just as a former inmate, but he had formerly been a reporter for the Morning Call, where he had got an up-close look at what he considered the slow, corrupt machinery of the city's courts. But now, beginning in the summer of 1865, Twain hammers the city's cops relentlessly for being shiftless, cruel, and inept. In fact, Twain's attacks are so fierce and so embarrassing to the police department that the city's police chief actually retaliates with a libel suit against the Enterprise, and his men even jail Twain overnight for public drunkenness. Although knowing Twain, it's possible he was drunk in public. Fortunately, these efforts at intimidation didn't work. As late as February 1866, Twain hadn't let up. "Mark Twain is still on the war path," noted the San Francisco Examiner at the time. "He is after the San Francisco policemen with a sharp stick." One of the themes of Twain's Enterprise columns is the contrast between the image of the police as a kind, humane, generous institution, those are his words, and the fact of their violence, laziness, and corruption. Twain is especially angered by how the cops treat the Chinese. They harass Chinese residents of San Francisco regularly, arresting them for trivial or made-up offenses, yet consistently fail to intervene when white mobs brutalize the Chinese, as they did frequently in those days in San Francisco. In my view, Twain's most powerful commentary on this particular injustice is his 1870 piece, "Disgraceful Persecution of a Boy." The piece centers on a boy who throws stones at a Chinese man because he had been taught it was his sacred duty. And I'm sure the piece is quite familiar to all of you, but I love the writing so much that I'm going to quote it a little bit for us. "It was in this way that the boy found out that a Chinaman had no rights that any man was bound to respect, that he had no sorrows that any man was bound to pity, that neither his life nor his liberty was worth the purchase of a penny when a white man needed a scapegoat, that nobody loved Chinamen, nobody befriended them, nobody spared them suffering when it was convenient to inflict it. Everybody, individuals, communities, the majesty of the state itself, joined in hating, abusing, and persecuting these humble strangers. And therefore, what could have been more natural than for this sunny-hearted boy, tripping along to Sunday school with his mind teeming with freshly learned incentives to high and virtuous action, to say to himself, 'Ah, there goes a Chinaman. God will not love me if I do not stone him.' And for this he was arrested and put in the city jail. Everything conspired to teach him that it was a high and holy thing to stone a Chinaman. And yet he no sooner attempts to do his duty than he is punished for it. He, poor chap, who has been aware all his life that one of the principal recreations of the police out toward the gold refinery was to look on with tranquil enjoyment while the butchers of Brannan Street set their dogs on unoffending Chinamen and make them flee for their lives." What's so exceptional to me about this piece is how Twain frames the boy's behavior. He doesn't present the racist attack as a case of individual bigotry, but as a social phenomenon. This isn't the story of one rotten apple, but of a rot that goes to the roots of how society is constructed. The system isn't malfunctioning. On the contrary, it's functioning exactly the way it was designed to. In today's terms, we would say that Twain is talking about structural racism. He doesn't dwell on personal prejudice and isolation. Rather, he illuminates an entire machinery, legal, political, spiritual, that has conspired to make a young boy commit an act of racist violence. Twain later embeds this insight into how racism is produced and reproduced in society into Huckleberry Finn, right? In the famous moment when Huck decides not to betray Jim, which again, I cannot resist quoting for you. "I studied a minute, sort of holding my breath, and then says to myself, 'All right then, I'll go to hell,' and tore it up. It was awful thoughts and awful words, but they was said. And I let them stay said and never thought no more about reforming." I won't belabor my analysis of this passage because it's some of the most analyzed words in all of American literature. And many of those who have performed the best analyses of those words are probably sitting in this room. Shelley Fisher Fishkin, who I didn't realize was receiving an award tonight, so it all worked out perfectly, has written that the core question at stake here is how can a society that debases human lives on a mass scale consider itself civilized? It's a perfect way to put it, right? Because the boy who throws stones at the Chinese man considers himself civilized. God will not love me if I do not stone him, he says to himself. By contrast, Huck, in the moment that he decides to help liberate Jim, considers himself uncivilized. All right then, I'll go to hell. Twain's point here, when you think it all the way through, is pretty terrifying. He's saying that these acts of humanity are not the result of society falling short of its ideals, but rather of a society that believes it's putting its ideals into practice. Again, the system isn't broken. It's working the way it's supposed to. It's not that we're not living up to the promise of American life. It's that what American life promises is evil. I'm reminded here of the work of Erich Fromm, the German psychologist and philosopher who, in his 1955 book, The Sane Society, reckoning with the recent history of Nazism and Stalinism, proposed the idea that it wasn't just individuals who could be mentally ill, but that a whole society can be sick. The fact that millions of people share the same vices, he wrote, does not make these vices virtues. The fact that they share so many errors does not make the errors to be truths. And the fact that millions of people share the same mental pathology does not make these people sane. So where does this all leave us? After all the turns I've taken us through, are we any closer to answering our initial question of how we might apply Twain to our own political moment? Is there any hope for bringing his intelligence to bear on the problems we face as a country and as a species without trying to ventriloquize him, without putting words in his mouth? One thing that occurs to me is this. If a whole society can be sick, then sometimes it takes an act of insanity to be sane. If a country's ruling class is committed to the idea that certain kinds of cruelty are a cornerstone of civilization, then sometimes it takes an act of barbarism to be truly civilized. I belong to a generation that has come of age at a time of never-ending war, crisis, and stagnation. September 11th, Iraq, financial crisis, the long shadow of the Great Recession, the gathering emergency of climate change. These are the moments, historical and ongoing, that have shaped the political consciousness and material reality of those young Americans we call millennials. It's no coincidence, then, that many of us have lost faith in the wisdom of our elders, in the established institutions of American life, even in the system of capitalism itself. It's not merely that young people suffer disproportionately from our era's many catastrophes, that we face particularly bleak economic prospects, earning less money than our parents did at their age and suffering from higher rates of poverty, or that we stand to inherit a hot, soggy hell of a planet, destabilized by toxic levels of carbon and the disastrous legacy of US military intervention. It's that these failures are so frequently presented by our country's ruling class as triumphs, as the fulfillment of our nation's ideals. It's that no lessons are ever learned, but rather each catastrophe seems only to be perpetuated and amplified by doubling down on the decisions that produced them. As a result, many of us have come to a somewhat Twainian realization. The system isn't broken, it's working as it's supposed to, it's simply not working for us. So it's precisely at a juncture like this, I'd argue, that Twain's brand of vulgarity is so desperately needed. We need a truth-telling that speaks of life from below, that probes the rift between elite rhetoric and popular reality, that documents in granular detail the whole social machinery that produces and reproduces injustice. We need people like Huck, who are willing to burn in hell in order to make the earth a better place. We need new lunatics to make society sane again. We need new barbarians to save our civilization from itself. Thank you so much.